From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson, broadcasting today from Cincinnati Public Radio in Ohio. It's Here and Now. President Trump is holding a rally in Cincinnati tonight, the day after Democratic presidential candidates made each other, and in particular, the frontrunner Joe Biden, their main target in their second debate on CNN last night. Party divisions were on display on immigration. We're going to get to that in a moment with USA Today's Alan Gomez. But also on health care, Biden accused Kamala Harris of having several different Medicare for All plans.
And to be very blunt and to be very straightforward, you can't beat President Trump with double talk on this plan.
Your response, Senator Harris?
Absolutely. Unfortunately, Vice President Biden, you're just simply inaccurate in what you're describing.
NPR politics reporter Danielle Kurtzleben joins us from Washington with more. Hi, Danielle.
Hello.
So all the candidates were attacking Biden last night and each other on a wide range of issues, less so attacks on President Trump. What did you make of that?
I mean, a lot of what's going on here is that these people, especially since there were 20 people debating this week, they're just trying to differentiate themselves from each other. For a lot of Americans, this is the first time they're meeting a lot of these candidates. So, I mean, it would be hard for a Democrat in this field to differentiate themselves from the rest of the field by attacking Trump, because they all don't like Trump. They all largely don't like his policies. So a lot of what they're doing is attacking each other. And by the way, a big part of that is also, I suppose one way you could put it is punching up, attacking the people who are doing well. You don't see the people who are on the outer fringes of the stage getting attacked as much. So they were really attacking Joe Biden and Kamala Harris last night in particular.
And on the issue of health care, there is division. Do you think that the Medicare for All option, which Sanders and Warren and Kamala Harris are in favor of, or the kind of Medicare for All who want it, they're calling it, or more of a public option, just minor or maybe not so minor, but tweaks to Obamacare, which is winning right now in the Democratic field?
That's a great question. I mean, it's hard to really generalize like that. I mean, one thing you can say is that at the very least, the Medicare for All branding has won because candidates who are in favor of that public option, which really would be, let's not undersell how big of a change it would be. It would be creating a government-administered plan and allowing people to buy into it. That could create some really big changes. Now, the fact that they're calling that plan Medicare for All who want it shows just how well that calling it this works, because Medicare itself right now is a very popular plan, and that's a thing that Bernie Sanders latched onto when he created his Medicare for All plan. But, I mean, one thing that you can say is that there is a nuanced thing happening here. There are a lot of Democrats who don't think Obamacare is bad, but they don't think Obamacare went far enough. And that is a debate that's happening right now, with Biden saying, you want to blow up Obamacare, Sanders and Warren saying, no, 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 we want to just go much further.
Climate change also came up last night. Here's Washington State Governor Jay Inslee, who has made this his top issue.
We cannot work this out. The time is up. Our house is on fire. We have to stop using coal in 10 years. And we need a president to do it or it won't get done. Get off coal. Save this country and the planet. That's what I'm for.
Now, I'm currently reading David Wallace Wells' book about climate change. And if you believe, as he does, that it is a major crisis, you watch Inslee last night. He was the only person on stage taking it as seriously as many believe it needs to be taken. Is Inslee kind of the Bernie Sanders of climate change, meaning he's getting the party to move in his direction on this key issue?
That's possible. I mean, you could say that he and also a few other people in the party, for example, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, New York representative, who helped put forward that Green New Deal. Mm-hmm. She has also kind of shaken some people awake and pulled them over to her side on this. Now, of course, that deal is very heavily criticized, but you do have people like Inslee and her various others who are saying we have to pay attention now. Now, as far as how successful he was last night, he did manage to land some blows on Joe Biden, for example. He did criticize Joe Biden's climate change plan and showed that he, Jay Inslee, really has done his homework on this and really cares about it. Mm-hmm. But as far as whether this helps him gain traction and move forward, I'm going to give you that obnoxious answer of we have to wait and see.
Well, OK, so then let's look forward to how long this could go on. The Iowa caucuses are not for many more months. Mm-hmm. The Democratic convention is next summer. What's next in terms of where we'll be in this contest? What's the qualification for the next debate in September?
Sure. So candidates have to get 130,000 unique donors and get at least 2% support across four qualifying polls. Thus far, as only seven candidates have qualified for that. More could still qualify, but we could see a much smaller field come September. On that debate stage, that is.
Yeah, well, and we'll see how long this goes on. Daniel Kurzleben, right. NPR politics reporter, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, let's pull one thread from last night's debate, immigration, and more specifically, the attacks on former Vice President Joe Biden because of the number of deportations at a time in the Obama presidency when some critics called Obama the deporter-in-chief. Here's New York City's Mayor Bill de Blasio.
Vice President Biden, I didn't hear your response when the issue came up of all those deportations. You were Vice President of the United States. I didn't hear whether you tried to stop them or not using your power, your influence in the White House. Did you think it was a good idea or do you think it was something that needed to be stopped?
Mr.
The president came along and he's the guy that came up with the idea, first time ever, of dealing with the Dreamers. He put that in the law.
Biden referring there to President Obama's DACA program, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, which grants some young adult immigrants who are brought to the U.S. as children temporary protection from deportation. But Biden sidestepped the question about deportations. There were also debates last night about whether people who cross the border should be civilly or criminally charged. What's the difference? Let's bring in Alan Gomez, immigration reporter for USA Today. Alan, I was watching the debate with someone who was yelling at the TV screen, why isn't Biden saying that President Obama only deported criminals? And maybe it's because that's not entirely true. Talk us through what happened under Obama when it came to deportation.
Yeah, the Obama deportation record is really a tale of two terms. In roughly the first half of his presidency, he was trying to negotiate a comprehensive immigration reform bill with Congress. Then during that time, he was unquestionably cracking down on immigration enforcement. His Department of Homeland Security set a record three different years for the total number of people deported, and they were really diving into that. All that was part of an effort to convince Republicans that he could be trusted to carry out the enforcement measures that were part of whatever they passed. Mm. And they came close. Senate passed a massive immigration overhaul in 2013, but then the Republican-led House refused to even debate it, so that died.
Well, so you're saying that this was early on. The president was deporting people for minor offenses, maybe not having a license while driving. I mean, that was true. But as you say, it was to try to get a bigger prize?
Yeah, I mean, this was all during the context there is important because this was all during the time that they were trying to negotiate with these Republicans. There are some caveats in there about the way that they reclassified deportations at the border and removals. But overall, the numbers were high and they were definitely going forward with that.
Well, and again, according to a New York Times analysis in 2014, 2/3 of the nearly 2 million deportation cases involved people who had committed minor infractions, traffic violations, or had no criminal record. 20%, I mean, thousands, 394,000, did have serious crimes. But okay, so that's early on. Then what happened?
So after the congressional bill failed, they changed their tune. The number of traditional deportations, those carried out against people living in the interior of the country, plummeted. From a high of 237,000 in 2009 all the way down to 65,000 in 2016. So the overall number of interior deportations fell. And on top of that, what they did was they started prioritizing who they were going to go after. And they started going after, because they heard all those criticisms, so they started going after undocumented immigrants with serious criminal records. Mm. Early on in the administration, the percentage of undocumented immigrants arrested by ICE who had a criminal record was pretty low. By his last month in office, it was close to 90%. Mm. And just for some context, that percentage has plummeted again under Trump.
Okay, there's that. Then another debate we heard last night, whether crossing the border without papers should be a criminal or civil offense. Now, Julian Castro has been one who wants to decriminalize it, make it just a civil offense. He also served in the cabinet of the Obama administration. Biden not on board. He said, I have enough guts to say this plan doesn't make sense. put the debate aside, what does it mean?
Okay, traditionally, most people who cross that southern border were went through civil deportation proceedings. That means you were detained, you were given a court date to appear in immigration court, and you were generally allowed to enter the country to go about living and waiting for that court date. By slapping a criminal charge on people coming across, what that does is transfer them into immigration detention. It increases the fines, it increases the possible jail terms, and to the point that right now most people in federal prison are in prison over immigration violations.
And Alan, before we let you go, many of the candidates talked about going to the border and seeing children in cages, as they're referred to. But these cages were not built by the Trump administration.
Correct. These are Border Patrol facilities that have been there, some since the 80s and the 90s, built in the 2000s even. And they were designed for mostly single adults who used to be the majority of people crossing the border. Now it's mostly families coming across the border, so they weren't designed for that.
No. Alan Gomez, immigration reporter with USA Today. Alan, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Here and Now is supported by Daily Harvest. Daily Harvest delivers carefully sourced, chef-crafted smoothies, soups, harvest bowls, overnight oats, and more, all built on fruits and vegetables. Each single-serving cup can be prepared in minutes. Daily Harvest is designed for convenience, so you can load up on fruits and vegetables first thing in the morning, before bed, and any time in between. Learn more about Daily Harvest and get 3 free cups in your first box when you go to dailyharvest.com and use promo code NOW. That's dailyharvest.com. Use promo code NOW.
News to note, a woman was killed early this morning in Lincoln County, Kentucky, when a gas line exploded in a residential community and sent flames towering into the air. 5 other people were injured. Several structures burned. Smoke from the fire could be seen more than 100 miles away in Louisville. Sue Routine was evacuated from her mobile home. She told WLEX-TV that she thought an airplane had crashed.
Our windows were shaking really bad. And our doors, the ground, you could hear the ground just moving and tumbling and rolling. And then we got to feeling the heat from the fire. And so we got in our vehicle and got away from it.
The explosion in Kentucky happened just hours after officials outside Houston said they'd contained an inferno that erupted yesterday at an ExxonMobil chemical plant. That fire injured 37, sent plumes of smoke into the air. Residents were ordered to shelter in place for several hours while air quality was assessed. The industrial city of Baytown, 25 miles outside Houston, is no stranger to chemical fires. In March, one broke out at another ExxonMobil plant. Health officials say it released toxic pollution into the atmosphere for days. The Houston Chronicle reports that since 2016, a major chemical incident has occurred once every 6 weeks. We want to turn now to aviation, past and present, with a story about the Spitfire, the iconic warplane from World War II.
German fighters waited overhead for the defending planes of the Royal Air Force, the RAF, to appear. They didn't have long to wait.
The Spitfire helped win the Battle of Britain against the Germans in the skies over England in 1940. But more recently, they rolled down the runway at the Duxford Battle of Britain air show in 2018.
Builds to a crescendo. Here they are, the Spitfires on the roll.
That sound. Maybe you made it as a kid holding aloft a model airplane. It'll be heard again next week as a restored World War II-era Spitfire will fly again. On Monday, British pilots Steve Brooks and Matt Jones will take off on an adventure being called the Longest Flight. The goal? To fly around the world, a pilot's Everest. One of them, Steve Brooks, joins us from London. Welcome.
Hi.
You know, we heard a little bit from that sound. People might also be thinking, you know, when I say Spitfire, Snoopy with his goggles, you know, and his red scarf blowing in the wind. Just first remind us, this Spitfire, you know, the place that it holds in the hearts of Brits.
The Spitfire is one of the most iconic, I think, machines that man ever made, really. Because it stands for freedom, it's a flight in itself. Ever since the Wright brothers took off in the States to the sky, people up to that point had said that man will never fly, and they proved that wrong. And so flight has been one of the greatest freedoms of mankind. But the Spitfire was a plane that was built not as an aggressor, but as a defender, to defend freedom. And that job it did. And it didn't just do it in the UK, but it did it across the globe. And so I think when you say Spitfire, it conjures up that sense of overcoming the unovercomable, of fighting the tyranny and winning.
Well, talk about this Battle of Britain. We just heard a little bit of it. It's 1940. Hitler has sent 2,600 Luftwaffe fighters. You know, Germany was thought to have the superior military and certainly air force. And his aim, Hitler's aim, was to destroy the Royal Air Force, the RAF. The RAF only had 640 fighters. And, you know, Goering and Hitler felt this is going to be a snap. We'll just wipe out this air force. And what happened?
Well, what happened is they came up against the Spitfire, which was designed by a man called R.J. Mitchell, who went to Germany when he was not very well. He had cancer and he was recovering from cancer when he took his son to an air show. And he saw these planes flying. This is about 1935. And he said, oh, my God, there's a new technology here. And these guys, this is aggressive. And if we don't do something about it, we're going to have no defense for it at all. He came home and he was told by his doctors to rest. And he said, I can't rest. I have a job to do. And he worked tirelessly for a couple of years, built the Spitfire and died 6 months later. So he never saw the war. But he knew that he was building something for the freedom of mankind. And that's what he left us.
Wow, that's an incredible story. And what happened when Hitler's Luftwaffe came in is that they were met with wave after wave. It almost... my imagining of it, it's like angry insects, you know, these Spitfires that just kept taking off and going after the Luftwaffe.
Well, yeah, they were fighting for their freedom. And that's what I think that's what the Spitfire stands for. And what we're looking forward to do is going around the world and showing people, letting them hear that Merlin engine for themselves and letting the Spitfire fly around the world again so people can see the glory of it. But we've taken away the guns and we've taken away the camouflage, so you can see the beauty of this machine and the precision engineering of it.
And by the way, was this one of the machines that was in the Battle of Britain? And what happened at the end of that is that the RAF downed almost 2,000 German planes. The RAF lost about half of that, 1,000 planes, but the war took a turn, you know, in Britain's favor. But this plane, this Spitfire, what era is that from?
So this Spitfire is from 1943, and it flew 51 times in the war and 51 missions, and then shortly after the war went to a museum. And so when we rolled it out 3 years ago, it was all there, but it had to be completely rebuilt. So we stripped 80,000 rivets out of it, and with the help of IWC.
80,000? Those little rivets, those like the little screws, 80,000?
Yeah, that's right. Imagine that. 80,000 rivets, all put together by the girls up at Birmingham who built these Spitfires. And we had to drill every one of them out. And then with the help of IWC, which is the International Watch Company, they're obsessed by precision, as are we. Mm. And we've gone through every little panel and piece of the plane and put it all back together. Mm. And so the plane that'll be flying over America will be a totally original machine.
Well, and by the way, I'm assuming people have a mind's eye picture of this. If they don't, I mentioned Snoopy, but it's a single cockpit, snug, and it has specific markings on the wings and fuselage. Can you describe a Spitfire?
Well, the Spitfire, this one is a silver Spitfire. So what we've done is they were made of aluminium. We've polished the aluminium. So it looks like... It is the most iconic shape ever made. And so to see it in the sky, you're going to look up in the sky, going to hear a roar like nothing else. It's the largest petrol engine ever built. And you're going to look up and you're going to see a shape of an elliptical wing, which was the most efficient wing ever designed. And it's just special. It's just different. And what's going to be fun is bringing that to America and showing it to the Americans who really understand aviation in your country. You've got a great understanding of it. And so sharing that with America is going to be fantastic.
Well, first of all, I love hearing a Brit describe something built of aluminum, which is what this plane is made of. Many of the Spitfires have round markings called roundels. This one doesn't. It's the MKIX Mark 9, the silver Spitfire. We'll have pictures at herenow.org. And you are sharing this trip with Matt Jones. So what is the plan? I mean, and what's the rigor of it? Because we're reading a lot of the, you know, press accounts of how rigorous this is. Well, you're going to be flying and landing and flying and landing. So what's the muscular part of it for you guys that makes this a challenge?
Well, it's going to be 27,000 miles to get around the world, 30-odd countries. Well, probably about 100 flights for us because we haven't got a huge range. And so it's going to be day in, day out, keeping the machine going. We'll have an engineer with us. So making sure that the machine's in good condition. It's a 75-year-old machine, and the technology from that era. And so it's going to take a lot of care to look after it.
Well, and in the air, I'm imagining it's going to be noisy. I mean, you, if I understand, flew a helicopter from pole to pole. You've had other flight adventures. But is this one, I mean, when you're actually in the plane, I'm imagining it's going to be noisy. Are you wrestling to keep it? I mean, what's the physicality of flying it, if there is one?
Yeah, it's a very noisy machine. It's a very fast machine. You're sort of 250, 300 miles an hour. And so the noise is very loud and things are happening very quickly in the cockpit. So you just need to be on your game. You've got to know where you're going, what you're going to do when you get there. You just got to be 5 steps ahead of it all the time. It's the most beautiful machine to fly. You sort of wear it like a jacket rather than sit in it. And you, where you look, you go, and it's as if gravity itself falls away. So it's the most beautiful thing to be in, but you do have to be on your game because it all happens very, very quickly.
That's Steve Brooks. By the way, he has a flight school that teaches people how to fly Spitfires. And along with Matt Jones, he's going to fly a vintage Spitfire around the world. We will follow that trip. We'll have more information at hereandnow.org. Steve, good luck to you, and thank you.
Great. And if anyone wants to follow it, if they go onto silverspitfire.com or IWC.com, they'll be able to see where the plane is or in the world and how we're getting on and see the wonderful pictures of how iconic it is.
Steve, thanks so much.
Okay, thank you.
So the Spitfire, a World War II icon. By the way, earlier I mentioned Snoopy, and I know in the Peanuts comic strip, Snoopy imagines himself as a World War I ace battling Germany's the Red Baron in the skies over Europe, all from atop his doghouse. The Royal Guardsman turned that into a song in 1966. Snoopy fired once, and it fired twice, and that bloody Red Baron went spinning outside.
Congress is considering whether to provide more benefits for service members and veterans whose war injuries have left them infertile. Texas Public Radio's Carson Frame reports for the American Homefront Project.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Army veteran Jason Gibson lives with his wife, Kara, and daughter, Quinn, in central Ohio. They spend a lot of their days coloring and playing hide-and-seek.
10, ready or not, here I come.
For the Gibsons, family life hasn't come easy. In 2012, in an IED blast in Afghanistan, Jason lost both legs and suffered shrapnel injuries to his groin.
Do you remember how Daddy got hurt?
Stepped on a bucket.
He stepped on a bomb.
No one in the military health system talked to the Gibsons about possible fertility problems until a year later, when a nurse practitioner said she'd noticed a pattern with blast injury patients.
All of a sudden, she just brought up, "Hey, have you guys gotten a sperm count yet?" And the thought just never crossed our mind. We just kind of assumed that everything would be okay.
After the trauma, Jason's sperm count was practically nil, and it didn't improve. The couple was told they had no chance of conceiving a child naturally and would need to rely on uterine insemination methods, or IVF. Still, they received little support from the military and its insurer, TRICARE.
TRICARE would cover, like, IUI, and they would cover some of the IVF medications, but when it comes to the actual procedure, egg retrieval, sperm retrieval, freezing of embryos, that they don't cover that.
In 2014, after Jason was medically retired from the Army, the Gibsons paid for IVF mostly out of pocket, shelling out more than $10,000. Quinn was born 9 months later. Since then, the situation has improved somewhat. In 2016, Congress directed the VA to cover IVF for people whose fertility problems are service-related, but that can be difficult for couples to prove. And funding for that VA program is uncertain. Congress has been approving it 1 year at a time, meaning it could go away as soon as the end of September. Senator Patty Murray of Washington State wants to make it permanent.
Although we have passed a form of this bill in our yearly appropriations bills, it has caused a lot of confusion to our veterans, and that's why I have reintroduced this bill as permanent and defined it so specifically.
Murray also wants the VA to cover more types of treatments and offer them to more kinds of veterans, including non-traditional couples and those who need donor sperm or eggs. But the cost of Murray's bill has been a roadblock, and so have religious objections. Gynecologist Kathleen Raviel is past president of the Catholic Medical Association. She says they support veterans but oppose IVF.
It takes away from the couple, the having the child. It puts it into the laboratory. So the lab technician chooses the embryo or the embryos, maybe one, two, or three embryos will be implanted in the woman. The rest may be discarded, and these are human lives.
Senator Murray takes issue with that.
Go talk to these men and women whose one dream is to have children, and then ask yourself if you should impose your religious beliefs on them.
Now that the Gibsons have their family, they say they feel lucky, but they still think of other service members returning from war and hope that the government moves fertility higher on its list of priorities.
There's this old saying that goes that if, you know, the military would have wanted you to have a family, they would have issued you one. And I've just kind of always felt that's how it's been. I mean, things like have improved, but at the time, we just kind of felt last.
For Here and Now, I'm Carson Frame.
I'm in Cincinnati today, where President Trump will hold a rally tonight. And while we're here, we gathered a group of Democratic voters in this crucial swing state of Ohio to talk about this week's Democratic debates. Our panel is 45-year-old Colleen Bowman, 23-year-old Jonathan Tewelde, 59-year-old David Hughes, 29-year-old Cam Hardy, 39-year-old Gladys Pope, and 68-year-old Christine Zevon. Well, thank you all for coming in today. And let me just start by asking you, who stood out to you in both nights of debates? Let's not just do the one from last night, but the night before as well. Who stood out to you? I'll start with you, Gladys.
Elizabeth Warren.
Why?
She just was prepared. She was ready. She had plans. She had an explanation of how she was going to do everything. And it seemed like every topic that came to, she had a very clear, concise answer. And she wasn't as... I don't know, screechy to me as she's been
screechy.
The past. She seemed a little bit more tempered this time.
Cam, what about you? Who stood out?
I would say Kamala Harris stood out to me. She came out very fiery, and, you know, she wasn't all over the place like the most of the debates was overall.
Last night you thought she did well.
Yes.
Jonathan?
Yeah, I think I'm going to have to say Elizabeth Warren. I thought she came out with a certain sauce or a certain like swagger to her approach to it. I think especially after last night's debates, I thought the heavy hitters didn't come with a big bat, or they weren't swinging heavy, and they took a lot of hits. So I feel like that exemplified Elizabeth Warren's performance yesterday.
Now, the youngest person on our panel. You're 23 years old.
I am.
Do you think about the sort of generational difference between some of the candidates? Does age matter to you?
Does age matter to me? I think not as much. I think it is a criteria that I do think about. But for the most part, I think if you have a vision, I think Bernie Sanders said that. But I think if you have a good path or something that and you bring excitement and energy, something that Elizabeth Warren, I thought, brought. Even Andrew Yang, I thought he brings something different to the table. I think a lot of like people my age are following Andrew Yang. I think he brings something different. Any candidate that brings something different, something unique, isn't riding the curtails of past administration. So Biden, I think if you bring those ideas, I think you can overcome any age gap that there might be.
Colleen?
I definitely think Elizabeth Warren had a very strong show.
Wow.
The first night. But I also thought Cory Booker came out really strong last night, which I was really happy to see because I like him a lot. I like what he stands for, but did not think he did as well in the beginning debate. So both of them were my standouts.
Christine?
Again, Elizabeth Warren, and I agree with everybody on the panel why, but I have to also add Corey, and I have to add Bennett.
Bennett,
yes,
Senator from Colorado.
Yes, it was nice to hear him speak more. It was nice to hear even Bullock speak more. We haven't heard Bullock. But I thought Bennett did a good job last night, and so did Corey. But Elizabeth is well-prepared and ready to be president.
David?
Well, two candidates who were just totally under my radar before the debates was Kamala Harris and Tim Ryan from
Ohio.
Northeast Ohio. I have to be honest, I'm looking more at who's going to be the vice president.
Hmm.
Because I think at this point, Joe Biden, he just keeps looking better in the polls. It's not my first pick, but there's the dream team and there's reality team.
Who's your first pick?
My dream team, I think, would probably be Warren and then Harris VP, something like that.
Uh-huh.
As much as I personally like Elizabeth Warren, I think she comes across as a little too far to the left.
Okay. So let's get then, because so many of you are fans of Elizabeth Warren, let's get to one of the big topics that came up in the last two nights, which is healthcare. And Elizabeth Warren is with Bernie Sanders on the Medicare for All proposal. What do you think about Medicare for All, even if that means getting rid of employer-based private health insurance? Christine, you're shaking your head.
I'm not in favor of universal health care at all. I feel like you should have private and presented to you. I'm on Medicare. I love Medicare. I love it, love it, love it. Mm-hmm. Great to turn 65 and not even worry about big bills or doctor bills. But having said that, I think people need the option. And maybe I'm from the old school, but just to say this is going to be rolled out and it's going to be for all does not make sense to me. And how they're going to pay for it doesn't make sense to me. I think let it continue, fix the Affordable Health Care Act that President Obama brought in, and then go from there.
Anybody disagree? Jonathan.
I kind of feel like last night was a couple great points are made in the fact that especially people around my age don't really stick to one job for so long, mm-hmm. and they constantly do switch. And the switching of jobs brings in the option of what happens with my health care. I think for people my age, I think the Medicaid for All or universal Medicare or whatever, I think that's something that a lot of us like, or specifically me, I don't know, something that I do vibe with or I like or whatever. From last night's Kamala Harris, and I think Andrew Yang brought those points up, and I agreed with them.
Gladys, what do you think?
I agree with Christine. You look great, by the way. I would have never imagined. But I was just thinking that I have employer-based health care. I have a family. It makes me feel secure that, I pay my premiums, we have insurance, we go to the same doctors, there's not too much of a change. I like the consistency and stability of my employer-based health insurance. And even though I do agree with, some form of universal health care, access to health care for everybody, I don't know that I would want to give up my private plan for a government plan.
Colleen?
So I struggle a lot with this because healthcare is very important to my family. My daughter's a cancer survivor, and I understand the point of wanting our choices and all of that, but I also struggle with it doesn't work as universal health care if we have the other option, because then, doctors can say, we're not going to accept this, we're only going to accept private. So then we still have the haves and the have-nots. And that's the big concern to me, although I understand the concerns, but I have concerns for the other side, because you're still going to have the same system if we don't have a universal plan for mm-hmm. everyone.
I want to ask you about climate change, which came up last night. And there are some candidates who believe it is the most important issue and some candidates who believe it is one of many important issues. We have a president right now who has said in the past that he thinks it's a hoax. How important is dealing with climate change to you? Do you think that there should be a candidate who thinks of it as a crisis that has to be dealt with immediately, even if it means you have to make some sacrifices? Or do you think that it is not the most important issue? Gladys.
I'm going to say it's among my top issues, because I think that, the environment, climate change, that is all to me tied into just like our future plans as Americans. And so the science does not lie. Like, you have to agree with facts. Scientists, researchers, all of these people have come to this conclusion. I trust that. I can see, like, the effects of the environment. I'm only 40 years old. But even things from when I was a child to now, I see
things have changed.
Find the differences in. Exactly. So thinking about my own children, future generations, what they would have to deal with, I think climate change should be pretty high priority for anybody who wants to be president.
Jonathan?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's a pretty pressing issue. I was telling one of my friends, I was like, I'm going to buy a property in Tennessee, and like, if we don't do anything, it'll be beachfront property in a couple years.
Yeah. No, we laugh at that, but yeah, actually,
but
there are many people who know what they're talking about who say that, I don't know about a couple of years, but in the next several decades, that we could be in a situation where some of the states that are inland become beachfront property.
Exactly. So if you're looking for some beach houses, Jeremy, I got you in like 50 years. But no, jokes aside, it's a pressing issue because it's not only an American issue, it's a global issue. In every movie, anytime there's an asteroid heading to Earth, the whole world seems to combine together and do something about it. But it's not an asteroid, it's our world, and I think we should definitely do something about it. So for me, if I was running for president, I'd probably say, yeah, this would probably be a top three, if not number one issue.
David, what do you think?
Well, I think, yeah, the whole issue of the climate crisis is going to keep growing, and it should be the elephant in the room. I was struck by John Delaney talked about a carbon direct air capture machine that sucks carbon,
capture, carbon
out of the
right.
air. I'd never heard of that. I also like Governor Inslee a lot. Actually, if I had my choice based on environment, he'd be my guy. But, you know, unfortunately, we have a party. The other major party is in total denial, and it's frustrating. And I think it's going to come back to bite us all.
That is David Hughes, one of several Cincinnati Democrats we're speaking with today after this week's debates, along with Colleen Bowman, Jonathan Tewelde, Cam Hardy, Gladys Pope, and Christine Zevon.
Welcome to August and the start of the final 2 months of baseball's regular season and the end of trading. The trade deadline passed yesterday with one blockbuster deal. The Houston Astros boosted an already strong pitching rotation by acquiring Zach Greinke from the Arizona Diamondbacks. The Yankees didn't make a big move, and the New York Post expressed fans' outrage. The whole back sports page is a mock-up of a picture of Yankees general manager Brian Cashman, made up to look like a zombie, under the headline, The Walking Deadline. Mike Pesca is here now, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. And Mike, notice we did not trade you.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. I know there were some prospects in the offing, yeah, but it didn't come through.
We decided to keep you. But what about this deal that the Astros made yesterday? Start there. Does this make them the World Series favorites?
They might have been before. So, yes, double yes. They have such a good rotation. It's a chock-a-block with Cy Young Award winners, and they have a great offense. And also, their primary opponent in the American League are those Yankees who didn't make a deal and probably do need a starting pitcher. Of course, the New York Post is going to take things to the extreme. They're one of the best teams. But a notable thing about this deadline, if you want to talk about the pun and the walking deadline, it really was a deadline in the past. The so-called deadline. You can always make trades afterwards through a complicated process of clearing waivers. I always wondered why they called it a deadline. It seemed like a wounded line or something much less than dead. This was it. If a player hadn't moved, if the player is on one team's roster today, that player is not, unless something, there are maybe some fantastical ways that you could get to another team, but it's probably not going to happen. So this kind of put a fire under the collective tookuses of a few teams, though not the Yankees.
And Tukas is butt. Okay. By the way,
Yiddish translation, yes.
By the way, fans of last year's champions, the Red Sox, were also kind of ticked off that, like the Yankees, they didn't do anything big. Can you just comment briefly on why the Red Sox this year are so weird?
They were so weird because they came in as the champions and, oh, what a juggernaut, and they were terrible for a little while, and then they started to get good again. But, you know, it is a big question about what their president of baseball operations, Dave Dombrowski, is doing. Is he discounting the present? It seems like he has a chance to go for it. They're a very smart team. You know what? Come October, they'll be right in the mix.
Okay, let's talk about some other stories. U.S. Soccer released a letter on Monday that said the players on the World Cup winning women's national team were paid more than their male counterparts from 2010 to 2018. What? Is that possible?
Oh, not only is it possible, according to their figures, which are correct and do rely on them starting the clock at 2010 for a specific reason and calculating it in a way that we'll get into, I hope, they're accurate. It is true that if you just look at the sum total paid to the women over that time, they got more than the men. So here are a few caveats. One, they played more games. I mean, that's important, right? Mm-hmm. Two, by going back to 2010, you include a cycle when the men made the World Cup. Making the World Cup gives you a lot more money. There's so much more money in the men's World Cup. And the second thing is they count their subsidization of the salaries for the Women's Professional League in those statistics. And I don't know what's right or wrong. I mean, if you were arguing, as the women themselves do in a letter rebutting and calling a ruse Carlos Cordero's, the U.S. Soccer Federation's letter, if you were taking their stance, they would say, don't count the salaries that you help pay for our club teams, because those are salaries from our club teams. But I could also understand the other argument, like the only reason that they're getting those salaries, these top players, is because the federation is paying them. So it does seem to me that there's a good deal of ballast to the argument that U.S. Soccer is putting out. And it further seems to me that the rebuttal letter, and this is a union negotiation and these things happen, contains a fair amount of, I would say, bluster. For instance, go ahead.
I was just saying, my head's exploding because we all saw the fans cheering, you know, equal pay.
Yeah, well, it turns out people, you know, chanting things in a stadium aren't always, you know, accurate.
What?
Okay. Well, this is from the U.S. National, essentially the union for the women's team. They write, the Cordero letter includes the claim that the U.S. women's national team lost $27 million over the past 11 years, but admits that is based on false accounting because the federation, quote, traditionally does not count any of the sponsorship, TV, or marketing money. What U.S. sports team makes money if they don't count TV sponsorship and marketing? So that kind of blew my mind. I said to myself, wait a minute. There's, in this letter from Cordero, he admits it's based on false accounting. And I went back and I read the letter from Cordero, and man, do they take that out of context. The part where Cordero talks about what we traditionally count is just an acknowledgement. Traditionally, however, these revenues have not attributed directly to either the women's or the men's team alone. So, like, this is definitely a union back and forth, and I support a strong union for the women trying to get their money. But no one's lying. Everyone's just positioning. I would say that.
Ah, okay. We'll pick this up again with you. Mike Pesca here now, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
You know, the deadline is passed, but no, we're going to keep you. We're going to keep you. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
Took us, translator Robin Young. I'm Jeremy Hobson. Today at Cincinnati Public Radio, this is Here and Now.